You may be seated. Our last case this morning is 2015-1340, Jessica Jacobson versus Ellen Kafori et al. For the appellants, we will first start with Mr. Leek.
I'm going to use the first 6 minutes on behalf of Akron Children's Hospital. Then 6 minutes will be for defendant Ellen Kafori. And then the rebuttal will be by the Cleveland Clinic Children's Hospital, 3 minutes reserved.
Thank you.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. My name is Doug Leek, and I'm here on behalf of the defendant appellant, Akron Children's Hospital. And on behalf of Akron Children's Hospital and the co-defendants, we ask that this court reverse the Ninth District's decision that erroneously determined that Revised Code 2307.60 sets forth an independent cause of action for criminal acts. Despite the legislature's intent, despite the clear language of Revised Code 2307.60, and despite almost 20 years of legal precedence, the Ninth District failed to recognize the jurisdictional nature of Revised Code 2307.60. And as a result, it has fundamentally altered the civil law in which now civil law and criminal law, the lines between them will be blurred. It is clear that pursuant to Revised Code 2307.60, that there is no independent cause of action for criminal acts. Revised Code 2307.60 is a jurisdictional statute that states that any person injured by a criminal act may recover damages pursuant to a civil cause of action authorized by either common law or statutory law. Revised Code 2307.60 is the codification of the common law rule that the civil actions are not merged into criminal actions. Criminal acts that can be pursued in civil court are only authorized by common law or statutory law. For example, the crime of kidnapping can be pursued under the common law cause of action, false imprisonment. Similarly, the crime of rape or sexual assault can be pursued under the common law cause of action for assault and battery, as the federal court recognized in TP versus Weiss.
And there's no need for a conviction. You would agree with that?
Well, there has to be allegations that we have case law out of the First District and the Ninth District in Tri-State out of the First District that says you have to plead either that they've been charged or convicted. But that's not an issue here. We never get to that point. We're trying to distinguish that Civil Rule 2307.60 is just for damages.
But there were no criminal charges here.
Correct. Correct. But we don't even get to that issue. And once again, there is case law, and also out of the Ninth District, the Collins case also said that there has to be a criminal conviction. But we don't even get to the merits of that, because here we're trying to confirm that 2307.60 is a damages only, authorizes damages and not an independent cause of action.
But you said there were common law causes of action that could be asserted.
Exactly.
And the burden of proof in those would be different from the burden of proof in the criminal action.
Exactly.
So why would you need a conviction if the standard of proof is less for a civil action than for the criminal action?
Well, that's the whole point, is that that's what's blurring the difference between the two causes of actions. You need a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt for a criminal case, whereas the common law, there will be different elements for false imprisonment.
And it's a lesser burden of proof.
In a civil case.
Yes.
Correct. But here's the point here, is that they allege statutory criminal acts under 2307.60, which is not authorized under that section. And the legislature's intent is clear, that in order for them to pursue an action for criminal acts, it has to be pursued under a specific civil statute.
Well, the criminal acts arose by taking the child to Florida. Is that right?
Correct. There's other allegations with regard to what happened at the hospitals. Correct. Now, there are allegations as kidnapping that can be brought under the common law action for false imprisonment.
Was that done here?
No, they alleged only 2307.60, that justified their criminal statute cases, and it does not, and that's why the case was dismissed. False imprisonment would be the equivalent to the criminal kidnapping. And the point here is that the intent of the legislature is, in order to have a civil action for a criminal action, it has to come under common law or statute. For instance, this legislature enacted Revised Code 2307.61 for theft offenses.
You're arguing that the legislature has authorized certain civil actions arising out of criminal conduct.
Exactly.
And that this statute does not give an independent cause of action. That's your position.
Exactly. And other statutes, examples, 2307.611 for identity theft.
So this was a pleading problem?
Yes, it was. They pled.
And it was a pro se plaintiff that pled all this.
Yes.
But don't we have notice pleadings and weren't all the defendants on notice as to what she was really after or alleging the issue was, that so that if you're on notice at some point that can be corrected if it's a timing problem, statute of limitations is running and all of those kinds of things, that you're on notice what the underlying facts complained of are, and so once a lawyer gets in and handles this, could fix up the pleadings to allege a tort that is being complained of, a common law tort, for example.
Well, that's the point here, is that they gave us notice that they were pursuing specific statutes for the criminal conduct of kidnapping, child enticement, but those actions do not exist with 2307.60. They would have had to bring a common law action for false imprisonment. So the court determined erroneously.
Unless they would have been convicted of those actions, correct? Or those criminal. If they had been, if there was a charge in a separate proceedings, et cetera, and there was a conviction for kidnapping and a conviction for whatever the other, allegations were.
But they cannot bring those actions, regardless of whether or not there's conviction, pursuant to those statutes in conjunction with 2307.60.
They have to allege a civil common law, not just
separate.
Statutory.
Separate. And the only way you can allege a civil cause of action for a statutory under the revised code criminal action is the ones that we gave an example of, 2307.61, 2307.611.
So the conviction is only a matter of proof, an element of proof, and not... doesn't give rise to the underpinnings for the operation of 2307.60.
2307.60 does not authorize any civil action for a criminal act. It has to come under those numerous statutes that have been enacted to cover those crimes or under the common law. They can't allege those particular ones they did in this case in conjunction with 2307.60 because that's only jurisdictional and authorizes damages. To have the underlying cause of action, it has to either be a separate statute, 23.07.51, 40, we've got a whole list of them, 65 for Medicaid fraud. The legislature specifically enacted civil causes of actions incorporating criminal conduct and acts.
Right.
The ones they alleged have not been separately enacted. And at this time, and also the long history of the precedents, we've have the first district, second district, I'm sorry, the second district, third district, fifth, sixth, eighth, and tenth that have all held that revised code 2307.60 is not a substantive independent cause of action for all criminal acts.
It seems as though the majority focused on the first part of the statute and ignored the clause regarding authorized by the revised code or the common law of the state.
It has to be authorized by common law
or
a statutory enactment.
Okay.
And at that point, I'd like to hand it over to counsel for Ellen Cafori.
May it please the court, Audrey Benz on behalf of Ms. Cafori in this matter. To follow up on what Mr. Leek was saying, the ramifications of determining that 2307.60 is an independent cause of action would be very significant for courts and litigants in the state of Ohio, particularly as Your Honors brought up earlier, there is no definitive burden of proof. The statute itself requires a criminal violation. And in this case, with a civil matter, at a minimum, there would be confusion with jurors and in pleading requirements as it relates to how someone would prove a criminal violation in a civil matter.
Well, counsel, reading the Court of Appeals decision, they say that the trial court erred when it found that she failed to state a claim pursuant to a 12B6. And that's what was used in the trial court, one of the mechanisms that was used in the trial court to say this needs to be dismissed, correct?
Correct.
And so they said that that she didn't, I guess they're saying that she did plead enough to survive a 12B6?
They're saying that her cause of action does not exist, so it could not survive a 12B6 motion.
Wait a minute, not that the appellate court didn't say that.
I'm sorry, I thought we were speaking of the trial court.
No, I said the trial or the appellate court. They said that it was premature or it was error for the trial court to say that her claim would not survive a 12B6.
They indicated that it was not, her claim should not have automatically been dismissed simply because
it failed to state a claim upon which relief can be granted.
Correct, and they did not analyze anything further than that. In this case, because Revised Code 2307.60 does not create an independent cause of action, the court needs to look no further. It needs to look to no facts of the case or anything further in the case to evaluate whether a claim can survive.
If she had pled false imprisonment under the common law, would the answer have been different?
I don't believe it would have been different, but that was not the issue faced with the court in this case.
We'd still have to see if the statute was followed statute of limitations was met.
Correct. There would have been other issues with the civil cause of action for false imprisonment, but that is not what was pled. And in this case, she relied solely on 2307.60, which we request the court determine does not create an independent.
Counsel, let me follow you on that question, because I'm reading, you may find this odd, but I'm reading from the brief of the appellee.
Okay.
And they have a sentence that caught my attention that I'd like your response to. The issue in this case is whether crime victims in Ohio should be able to recover damages from the criminals who have injured them. Are you suggesting that the answer to that is no?
I am suggesting that the General Assembly in Ohio has created certain civil causes of action for the crimes that it believes should be recoverable in a civil arena, and it is able to create statutes for many things. And if 2307 was intended to be a general proposition that any crime creates a civil cause of action, there would have been no need for the General Assembly to create any other causes of action.
But counsel, that's 60 is written in the negative, is it not?
I don't believe it is written in the negative. I believe
anyone injured by a criminal act has and may recover damages unless specifically accepted by law. Are these criminal acts at issue in this case specifically accepted by law?
I believe that they are not specifically granted, which means they are specifically.
That's why I asked you if it's in the negative. Are they specifically accepted?
They are not, and the plain language of the statute does indicate that it has and may. It is not a shall, which demonstrates a jurisdictional component. I will reserve the remainder of time on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, before we begin, I neglected to identify that Justice French is not with us on this case. She's recused, and in her stead is Justice Jim Jensen from the 6th District Court of Appeals. Thank you, Judge. Counsel?
What's going on here?
I'm hoping you can all see that. May it please the court, my name is Don Screen, and I represent the appellee in this matter. And I've put the statute up because there's apparently some confusion about what it actually says and what it actually means. It's very important to focus on the plain language of the statute because I think that makes it clear that the statute does independently authorize a cause of action.
Counsel, how do you respond to the argument had the legislature intended this to be an independent cause of action there wouldn't have been a need in 2014 for the General Assembly to create the statute of identity theft?
Well, identity theft, among other causes of action, may have specific requirements, specific elements, statutes of limitations, affirmative defenses, none of which are contained in this particular general statute. There are many statutes that authorize particular civil causes of action for particular criminal acts, and then there's a general one. I'd like to refer to it perhaps as a catch-all provision. The revised code criminalizes many more acts than it provides civil redress for, and the General Assembly wanted to ensure that all victims of crimes had some redress, even if not specifically addressed elsewhere in the revised code, and that's exactly what the statute says.
I don't know that that answers the question. Why have specifics identified if you have this catch-all that covers any criminal act? Would you say that any criminal act will give rise to civil recovery?
Unless specifically accepted by law, yes.
But is there any, give me an example of a crime that's been accepted by law.
Okay. The dram shop statute, for instance, Your Honor, 4399.18. In fact, the prologue, the first clause of that statute said, notwithstanding the civil action created by 230760, no one may recover damages from a liquor license holder.
Okay.
So it would make no sense at all to have that introductory phrase if 230760 didn't independently authorize a cause of action.
Is the liquor owner subject to criminal sanctions?
Criminal sanctions, I'm not sure about that.
It's not in Title 29, though. It's in Title 43.
Right.
So it wouldn't be really the criminal statutes that we're talking about.
Right, not in that instance, right. There are a host of examples where the courts have recognized that plaintiffs may invoke 230760, plead the and prove the elements of the crime, and then recover civilly. And it happens to
without
be cases—
without identifying the actual elements of the crime or the civil action that is identified?
Right.
The
it requires that the elements of the criminal act be identified. And there are a host of these. There are a number of cases, and they tend to be cases where the law doesn't create specific civil causes of action for particular criminal acts.
Is that linked to a conviction for
no.
those actions? There's no conviction. There's
no conviction requirement.
I know there's no conviction requirement. I'm talking about the cases that you are referring to. Are they also cases where there was a criminal conviction?
No. It's possible that there were criminal convictions in some of them, but it was not an element. It was not something that the plaintiff was required to plead or prove.
No, but what I said earlier to opposing counsel is the criminal conviction just becomes then a very strong evidentiary
That's right.
Matter that you bring into the fold of the civil action, the actual...
That's correct. In fact, the second part of the statute, which is not reproduced here, speaks of the evidentiary value of a defendant having been convicted or having pled guilty. He's not at liberty any longer to deny his culpability in the civil action.
Is the term criminal act defined anywhere?
No.
So you're saying criminal act does not require a conviction?
That's right.
To be defined?
It does not. There are cases that say that if a criminal conviction were required, the statute would have said that. It says criminal act.
What cases are you relying on?
Okay.
Do you have anything from this court?
The Supreme Court has not taken up this particular issue before. There are a host of appellate court decisions, however, in which plaintiffs have been permitted to invoke 230760, come in and plead and prove the elements of the crime and recover civilly. Lizette versus Kalmaticki, computer hacking under 29.1304. TPVY, sexual battery under 29.07.03. Tomas v. Nationwide, 29.21.12, destruction of evidence.
And what appellate districts are we talking about here?
There are a number of them. B.V. Weiss is the 5th District. Lizette Phil Kalmaticki is the Northern District of Ohio. Tomas v. Nationwide is the 10th District. Gonzales v. Spofford is the 8th District. That's theft by deception under 2913. Cartwright v. Bantner, 2nd District. Theft and misuse of power of attorney. Red Ferris Chevrolet v. Aylesworth. That's the 9th District.
Did you just say the 10th District? Because that's one of the districts that is identified by the 9th as its decision conflicts with.
That's true. I noticed that myself. But there was a case, the Tomas v. Nationwide, in which the plaintiff was allowed to invoke 230760 and recover civilly for the defendant's violation of 292112, destruction of evidence. And when I look at the list, and I wonder if I were representing plaintiffs who have been victimized by these particular crimes, I wouldn't offhand know what particular civil actions might afford redress. And without 230760, my clients would be out of luck.
I'm still having difficulty, though, in talking about the criminal act and saying that there's no conviction needed. I mean, we have the presumption of innocence, and just because someone is even charged does not mean that a criminal act has occurred. So how you can say that an allegation without having the definite conviction can be sufficient escapes me.
Well, again, it's only necessary that a criminal act occur.
But a criminal act doesn't occur unless there's a conviction.
I would disagree with that. I would say the criminal act may have occurred, and the plaintiff may be unable, or the prosecutor may be unable to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt, but a civil plaintiff can certainly prove it beyond a preponderance of the evidence. If my computer's been hacked, then I may be able to prove that it's hacked. The prosecutor may not be able to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt, but if I can establish by a preponderance of the evidence, I can recover civilly. And I can't think of another civil statute that I could invoke that would afford me redress under those circumstances.
Are many of these cases that you're referring to related to insurance?
No. I think there are a couple that are, and I think I might know what you're getting at, and that is the consequences of reading 230760 as the 9th District has done. What does that do to the insurance industry and its ability to cover unanticipated losses? And I would say it's no different from the way it is now. For one thing, I can't think of a CGL policy that doesn't contain an exclusion for criminal acts or for intentional acts. If a cause of action arguably fits under this or some other civil statute that expressly refers to a criminal statute, it's going to be excluded by the CGL carrier because it's an intentional act.
Counsel, I frequently, over a long period of time, think that we get ourselves knotted up in the law sometimes over semantics, over words, and trying to make everything fit in certain categories. With respect to your specific case, that started out as a pro se complaint, is that correct?
Yes.
And it got tossed on a 12B6. And it strikes me that what the Court of Appeals is trying to come to grips with is that it was perhaps inarticulate in this case, in its initial formation, but that the defendants were on notice as to what actions and activities were complained of, and they may or may not be crimes, but they, if properly crafted, would fit into various causes of action at the common law, which is what you have to ultimately get to in a civil case, because that provides the framework in which damages can be assessed. So wasn't the Court of Appeals really trying to say, look, Judge, at the trial level, you had a pro se complaint filed. Instead of just knocking it out, you should have said, you need to get a lawyer, before statute of limitations? Is there an underlying statute of limitations problem here at this point, I assume?
There is in this case. There may well be. And I'm not suggesting that 230760 provides a vehicle for skirting a statute of limitations that would be applied to.
I understand that, but the argument, or it strikes me as what the Court of Appeals was trying to reach, is to say, well, there may be valid claims here, may or may not be. It's just not pled very well, but we have notice pleadings, so the defendants are on notice as to what they're after. So it should have gone another step.
And
isn't that really what the Court of Appeals was trying to achieve?
I think beyond that, the Court of Appeals decision is a recognition that under the plain language of the statute, a person who can plead and prove the elements of a criminal offense is entitled to civil redress. And if I could, I would like to address the principal argument made by Mr. Leake, that the 230760 is just a damages provision. If you look and read the plain language, says anyone injured in person or property by a criminal act has and may recover full damages in a civil action. That's not a damages provision. That confers a civil right of action. Two other points I'd like to make while I have this.
Let me ask you to stop you there for the moment. Would you think that you have a cause of action in kidnapping then? Or is that a battery? Or is it a false imprisonment? Or do you get to pick?
Pleading in the alternative is perfectly permissible.
But we don't have a civil cause of action for kidnapping. If someone is kidnapped, then you can allege false imprisonment, for example.
Right, there is a civil cause of action for false imprisonment.
So why would you think that you can allege a civil cause of action for kidnapping?
You may or may not be able to, and that's the...
Well, that's what the trial court said.
Right.
You can't, because the General Assembly hasn't said, we now recognize this as a cause of action for which you can recover money.
Right. And the Ninth District disagreed and said, to the extent you can allege the elements of the criminal offense, you do have a civil
action.
But
she didn't allege it. She filed a faulty pleading. And you would agree that pro se litigants are held to the same standards as parties that are represented by counsel, correct?
Correct.
So she has this document that's been filed, and as Justice O'Donnell just mentioned, you know, is it this? Is it that? Is it, you know, what's the underpinnings here? You know, for this injury, and you're saying, or I hear, well, they know what they did, so they should be able to defend against it. When in reality, based on her pleadings, they don't know what, you know, she recites some facts that happened, but, you know, even that is, you know, problematic. So unless that is amended and amended appropriately, but they never get to that. The trial court dismisses it because it clearly is a 12B6 issue. You're not stating anything upon which relief can be granted. And then the Court of Appeals takes it and they want to somehow, as Justice Pfeiffer said, you know, give her day in court. So they take 2307.60 and they blow it up and stretch it to dimensions that, you know, may or may not been intended, when really what they could have said was, we remand, you know, for amendment of the complaint. What I'm thinking is that the problem that we have here is the interpretation that the Court of Appeals put on 2307.60, and I'm not sure that this is the case to have done that. I'm not sure that that was warranted, but I certainly don't think under these facts and the procedural history that you can get and stretch this as far as you want it.
I think that the court did what enumerated the criminal statutes referred to in the complaint by Ms. Jacobson, and to the extent under notice pleading that those facts are sufficient to state a claim, or to invoke the particular criminal statutes to which she refers. That may or may not be the case, but I think the Ninth District's opinion is it's a hypothetical. If she had pled those elements specifically, would she be afforded civil redress?
But Mr.
It's just
Screen,
a matter for the state to
Mr.
To
Screen, you have the statute there on your placard, and the conditional clause is anyone injured by a criminal act has full damages and may recover, and then the conditional clause, if authorized by any provision of the rules of civil procedure or another section of the revised code or under the common law. It doesn't say plead kidnapping or plead, and that's why we have civil causes of action such as assault or battery or false imprisonment. And those are, on that conditional clause, authorized under a section of the revised code.
Your Honor,
so I think what we're trying to have you address is, why do you plead the criminal elements when we have, as the statute points out, causes of action?
Your Honor, I think if we look at the statute carefully, you'll notice that this if applies to the second right conferred by that statute, namely the right to recover costs and attorney's fees. There's another if down here. You can get punitive damages if authorized by Section 2315.21 of the Ohio Code. There are three rights conferred by this statute. The last two are conditional. You can get attorney's fees if X, Y, and Z. You can get punitive damages if A, B, and Z. The only restriction on the applicability of the first right is that the cause of action you're alleging is not specifically accepted by law. There's a huge logical difference between the ifs of clauses 2 and 3 and the unless in clause 1.
So you think that you can allege the criminal elements in a civil action on any charge?
As has been done
in
numerous cases.
And you think that's authorized by the General Assembly?
Yes, as has been in numerous cases.
Counsel, I read the statute and find your problem to be different than Justice O'Donnell finds it to be, and that's why our work is interesting among us all. But I look at it and it says anyone injured in person or their property by a criminal act has an absolute right to recover full damages that they can prove in a civil action. And there's your problem. It has to be a civil action, and the trial court found that you just, the pro se complaint just recited the titles of criminal acts and didn't explain what the civil action was. And on that basis, kicked it out. So I come back to, maybe it seems harsh, but that's your client, it would seem to me, if properly pled, has a chance to go at least one more step in the pleadings, but it has to relate to what's the civil action. Then if you want to say, throw in what leads you to think that you have that civil action is to a cross-reference to some various criminal statutes, but it has to be crafted in terms of what a civil action is. That's what the statute says.
And I think as the Ninth District held, this is the civil action. There needn't be a civil action specifically addressing a particular
So
crime.
You're saying a civil action is kidnapping because it's a crime?
The civil action, it's not like an ersatz criminal prosecution. She's not being sued for the kidnapping. She's being sued for damages resulting from the criminal act. To the extent she has damages, and to the extent those damages are traceable to the performance of the criminal act, she can recover civilly.
Counsel, you've used your time. You're over almost 5 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Apologize. Thank you.
All right. For the rebuttal, we have Mr. Lang, and you've got about a minute and a half.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. My name is Brian Lang, and I represent co-appellant Cleveland Clinic Children's Hospital for Rehabilitation. I think the court is correct here that 2307.60 does not set forth its own cause of action. And I'd like to address the numerous cases cited by opponents.
Well, before you do that, didn't the Cleveland Clinic really know what this pro se complainant was complaining about, and you didn't have any doubt as to the underlying facts, what happened and what the complaint was about?
In looking at the complaint, they were claiming kidnapping, which obviously could also be separately pled as a false imprisonment claim. To that point—
And you could identify what happened factually. I mean, what were the underlying facts that gave rise to this allegation?
Yes, that's correct, but there's still a technical deficiency in the complaint, and actually the pro se plaintiff was given an opportunity at the trial court level. There were multiple pretrials with the trial court judge, and he did ask the pro se party to obtain legal counsel and waited for months before granting the motion to dismiss.
Counsel, once you get into that technical difficulty, doesn't 12b-6 require everybody involved to accept as factually true that which is pled?
I agree with that, but with that—
The 12b-6 only, and I'm looking at, they're saying they coaxed her and enticed her to enter an aircraft, not acting within the scope of lawful duties that would authorize that. Isn't that, for the purposes of 12b-6, true?
The facts as alleged are true, absolutely, for purposes of 12b-6.
How do you get a motion to dismiss on those facts?
Because the complaint was very specific. Let's say, for instance, that the complaint didn't even state a cause of action and just alleged those facts.
Count four, because I don't have to go through the whole complaint. Count four.
Sure.
It's true.
If they're asserting a specific violation of a specific statute in there, which did not occur, which is the reason why the trial court dismissed the case, because that statute doesn't set forth an independent cause of action. If it did, there'd be no reason to enact all of these other statutes that set forth specific civil causes of action for violations of criminal statutes.
I guess I want to agree with you, but not on a 12b-6 analysis.
On a 12b-6 analysis, the legal issue before the court is whether or not this is a claim. Can you assert a cause of action for violation of 2307.60 for the crime of kidnapping? You can't do that.
Ignore the crime for a second and look at the acts. You enticed me to get on an airplane. You took me to Florida. It took me 8 years to get back. I want money.
I understand your position, but my position is that this court needs to address whether or not this statute sets forth an independent cause of action, which is why the trial court dismissed it, and it's why the Court of Appeals determined that it does set forth an independent cause of action. That's specifically in their opinion, and that's the conflict, and that's why this case is before this court, and the statute does not set forth that cause of action. 2307.51 was enacted 2 years ago. It's a very brief statute that sets forth a civil cause of action for the crime of human trafficking. There'd be absolutely no reason to enact that statute 2 years ago if 2307.60 set forth an independent cause of action.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you please adjourn court?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.